Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
Listening to the Green Majority. There we are. You're listening to the Green Majority on CIUT 89.5 FM. We have a show today largely about just very emotional, a lot of emotions, Stefan. Today's show is almost like about emotions because we're going to talk about people in a variety of different contexts and for a variety of different validities. I mean, for lack of a more polite way to say it, people who believe things very strongly. And these conflicting sets of beliefs, I think, is a general theme, is increasingly, as we're seeing, creating more tense conversations. And I wish I could tell you that the show is about how to solve that, but I'll just warn you now so you don't get let down later. We don't have the answer. But the interview who's at the end of the show may have part of an answer. May have at least a way to address it. If nothing else, it will make you feel better because it gives you a way to fight back in some small degree. We're going to be, at the very end of the show, talking to Nathan Glenn Phillips, who's a professor from Boston University, Department of Earth and Environment. And we're going to ask him why he's now been in the news for spending time on Breitbart. That is my teaser. I will leave it there. But he has been, and he has some important things to say about it. And it may provide you at least an outlet, if not hope. But before we get that, I have a bunch of news I've looked at, but recently we've been letting Stefan go first, so I'm just going to hand it over to Stefan here now.
Thank you very much. So my the beginning of my piece, shall we say, begins with a tweet from Eric Holthaus, or Holthaus? I feel like it's probably German, so I feel like it's probably a harder T, but to be honest, I don't know. But it starts with this idea of... and this tweet is pretty simple. It was a short thread posted last week about how this guy he's a person working on his 11th year working on climate change, including his last four in daily journalism. And the tweet this way says, "And today I went to see a counselor about it." What's interesting is that the thread then goes on to talk about in different terms, but essentially the existential crisis of being an environmentalist right now. You know, we've talked about the existential crisis that climate change, conjures in us as a whole, just due to its scope of danger to the world. But this is a much more personal existential crisis, and I think that's just as equally important to talk about. And it's I'm going to use that sort of as a way to talk about two different stories, because. As an environmentalist, when you're sort of facing climate change, I feel like you end up with sort of two ways of understanding, or two major ways, at least of interacting with government and lobbying government, of ways to sort of begin our mitigation process. And those are basically, regulation, like direct regulating of how much of different, carbon prices, or not carbon price specifically, but, of how much can go in the air, of cars can emit this much, et cetera, like direct regulation. And the other is more sort of shaping policy that more shapes and guides the country. So that's where I put a carbon price. I put a carbon price in that kind of policy versus regulation. And I think at this current moment, we're sort of seeing that dichotomy, especially in the international scale, and these two stories are largely tied to the United States, but I don't think they're necessarily – don't only exist there. But I think we're seeing that these both avenues being attacked on either side. And so the first story is this Volkswagen executive was charged on Monday with a conspiracy to defraud the United States. And this is just the next chapter in this ongoing scandal over the fact that Volkswagen basically intentionally created a system to avoid and cheat emission tests. And it's been going on and on. It's just years in the making. And they used a rig, a cheating device, used to rig U.S. diesel emissions tests from 2006 through 2015. So this is going on for 9 years. So here's, you know, the United States thinking it's successfully regulated an industry that is reducing its emissions. And then after 9 years of doing this, oh, wait, we've been intentionally defrauding you this entire time.
Can I just – I want to point something out really quickly before we move on. Think about for a minute – so this involved developing or at the very minimum mass producing, but probably had to require some development of a piece of technology that would then be mass produced and mass installed for 9 years. How sure were they – this is what's really interesting about this story. How sure were they that they would never get caught? Like this would obviously
– but here's the thing. I don't
think – obviously be a major scandal.
Oh, yeah. And I don't think they ever – this is what's fascinating about, you know, capitalism in general. I think they knew they would get caught, right? Because what's interesting about this is – I think it was Ford. And I may be wrong about this. There's a story from many years ago. I think it was Ford, but I'm going to admit that it's a American car manufacturer realized that one of its cars exploded or something. It was like one of these cars basically was so defunct, like one in 100,000 of these cars was so defunct that it was going to cause injury and death. And they had a meeting where they decided if they should tell everyone or not. And they basically came to the discussion that it was cheaper to not tell anyone and pay all the wrongful death suits than to pay anyone.
Well, some of the comedy shows pointed out that that they had a list of words that their employees were banned from using when discussing the cars, including maiming. Like it was really terrible.
Yeah,
it was fodder for comedy shows for weeks, despite the horrific nature of the story.
Well, and I think that speaks to what I haven't followed Volkswagen's pieces enough to know everything I want here, but it would not surprise me if they knew they'd get caught, and that wasn't the conversation.
I think what's interesting to me is that they kept going on with this piece of technology that would cheat the system when they could use those minds that are cheating to create a technology that actually just reduces greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, why do you continue to manufacture the same thing over and over again for 9 years when you can – maybe they did a cost analysis and there you go. Maybe it's cheaper to just keep lying than to
– yeah.
And we should, of course, because I neglected to introduce that you were here in the beginning of the show. The disembodied voice is Sabina, who people who have been listening to the show for a little while may recognize as well. So if you hear that voice jumping again, that's Sabina. She'll be around today. Sorry about that.
It's Oliver Schmidt. And what's interesting about Oliver Schmidt is that he only ran this part of VW, the compliance part, for the last year, basically, before they got caught. And yet he's the one facing charges. There might be some others, but he's the one that was charged on Monday. You know, it's going to cost them a pretty penny. It's between $3 to $4 billion settlement. That's the estimate. It hasn't been fully nailed down yet. But what's interesting about this is that – so this was a huge scandal. It's been going on for many, many years. And then just this week, you'd think that with all of this sort of stuff, you know, maybe, and again, if they would realize they'd get caught, but maybe that also doesn't matter because Fiat Chrysler, early this week, was accused by the U.S. EPA again for doing pretty much the same thing. You know, the cheating on its diesel emission testing by using a secret software applications in multiple models. And so this is no longer just Volkswagen being the bad egg. This is now a second major car company that has been flaunting their disrespect to simple regulation. This isn't a question of if you can't make cars. This is, you know, a regulation on diesel cars about how much their emissions can be. And at some point, you're just sort of like, you know, we're already looking at, like, they literally just watched Volkswagen go through the ringer. And yet, you know, there are studies that say that Volkswagen's still trusted by two-thirds of all Germans. So maybe what we're really telling all these companies is that they can 100% ignore regulations, pay our fines, and then go back to being exactly the same, because apparently there's no one goes – like nothing happens. You know, even if this guy goes to jail for, you know, for fraud – given that I don't trust the next big board meeting to have a conversation, be like and worry about this much.
It's the cost of doing business.
To some extent, yeah. And so that's the one side of this existential crisis, right? This is the side where, you know, you can fight and fight and fight to get a regulation passed and improve regulations, and then it seems as if we've just decided that if you have enough money to pay this large enough fine, it's not going to hurt you. You know, no one's stopping. It appears at least no one's really, you know, Volkswagen's is not going under because of this. I would be blown away if Fiat Chrysler really, you know, was damaged specifically by this. I'd honestly be surprised if you don't see something soon where, you know, the U.S. gives more money to Fiat Chrysler to keep 25 jobs in Michigan. You know, we're proving again and again that regulation is great if it's enforceable, and if it's not enforceable, then regulation is useless. So that's part one of the existential crisis. As we said, this is not going to be a happy show.
We can still use our happy voices.
That is true. But part two is actually Eric Holthaus ends his or right near the end of his sort of little tweet storm or whatever you call these things, which is that he's talking sort of about this fact that like this despair is natural and there's an objective evidence that shared existential problem we're not addressing adequately, and you know, we all feel alone because here we are trying to deal with this, and he gets this one line, which is just, but what am I supposed to do? Write another blog post? Our Secretary of State is the Exxon CEO. And I thought that one line is just so perfectly encapsulates the level of true despair that people who have been doing this for, you know, 11 years, as he has, feel on this sort of issue, right? Because it's like, he's right. Like when I think about whenever I get sort of anxious, I want to find a way, as you mentioned earlier, to have my piece of fighting back. And you know, given that I like to at least think of myself sort of as a journalist, that often comes down to writing something else. And you know, so but there aren't enough blog posts in the world that will stop Rex Tillerson from being the Secretary of State, and that's terrifying. And so, like, you know, Rex Tillerson, you know, was the CEO of ExxonMobil, who during his confirmation hearings repeatedly basically said, I don't remember anything about running Exxon, go ask Exxon, despite the fact that, like, no one believes him.
We have to keep in mind, this is not just someone who filled the position of CEO, like, as if you, like, you know, it's some sort of reverse Midas touch, where as soon as you work for an oil company, you're therefore, you know, you've been corrupted by definition. This person has never had another job in their entire adult life. He's been there for 40 years.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, like, he is Exxon. He's the CEO he's worked there for 40 years. He's the CEO. He's been spent quite a bit of time of that time as the CEO. Mm-hmm. Like, to say that there's now a separation between him and because he doesn't currently go to that building to go to his office is ludicrous.
Well,
he doesn't know anything else other than the business from the point of view of the oil company.
And not even multiple oil companies, just Exxon. This is a guy who has been at Exxon throughout the entire scandal of Exxon New. This is a guy who worked at Exxon in the 70s. When they knew that climate change was a thing, then continued to work at Exxon as they funded people denying climate change for the next 20 years.
Which also means that he was not just that, you know, oh, is it like guilt by association because he worked there and that company did something. Again, CEO.
Yeah.
He made that call. That was his decision to do that.
Well, he went up to CEO at the time when they're doing this. But
he had to green light it or be involved in it. But it's not like it just sort of like happened like, hey, what do you want me to do? Like, you know what I mean? Like it's not a situation of guilt by association, which I'm very cautious about doing. I don't like doing that. This is not a case of that.
Right.
These aren't my exact words, but I recently read an article and it was really funny. And the article said that appointing Tillerson as Secretary of State is exactly like appointing Ronald McDonald as Minister of Agriculture. And I thought that was extremely funny because it's true. I mean, your whole adult life, you've been having this job and you only think from that point of view. And I see that not only from people that I work with, I see that even from the professors that teach me. You go to a business class, the professor teaches you in a business class manner, whether he's teaching you sustainability or he's teaching you how to read a balance sheet. Like,
Or electing Stefan or myself the Minister of Journalism in Canada. Like, sure, you might, you know, if you're listening to the show, you might like our bias, so you might be in favor of us having that sort of power. But to say that we wouldn't have bias is insane.
Well,
of course I'd have bias.
Yeah.
Every environmental journalist in the country would immediately immediately get like a wage. But a wage. But just because you agree with that point of view doesn't make me unbiased. Of course I'm biased. That's nonsense to say that we wouldn't be.
Well, and I think that to presume that, you know, I think Sabina's point is very accurate that when you only have one, you know, this is someone who's worked his entire life to make Exxon shareholders money. And now is being asked to represent the American people, which he's, you know, arguably worked largely against for a vast percentage of this time. And what's interesting is none of that is the reason he won't get this job. That's the most ridiculous thing, is that if he is stopped, it has nothing to do with the fact that he is big oil personified. In his confirmation hearing, he got some pushback, which is lovely. And it's still a little up in the air whether or not he'll get through. I think he probably will get through, because I think, you know, I think the Republican senators are still too scared of the Trump base, basically, to fight back yet. I think they will eventually, but I think this is probably too early to expect that. During his confirmation hearing, he repeatedly ignored questions about his connections with Russia. He ignored questions about how he was doing business with Iran during the time there were sanctions. And it seems as if at least a couple, you know, Lindsey Graham, I believe, is one of them, and Marco Rubio, both sort of were a little more pointed in their attacks with them with him. And he actually does need all Republican support if he can't get any Democrats, because the Foreign Affairs Committee happens to be only have one more senator on the Republican side. So he actually needs all the Republican support if he can't get a Democrat.
Let's give credit where credit is due, because we like picking on people, so we have to say nice things about them when it's due. Rubio really went after him.
Oh yeah.
I watched the tape. He was not fooling around.
No, yeah. I think Rubio felt like took all of the ingrained shame that he had built up through just the demolishing of his character that happened last year and just unleashed it on
you know what? Actually, that actually makes a lot of sense to me. It kind of felt like he was like, because I mean, he got slapped around by Trump, right?
Oh, for the entire time, yeah.
So I kind of felt like he was like sort of taking out all his rage. I think you're right. I feel like he was taking out all the rage he's felt being completely humiliated by Trump over the last year, and he took it out on Tillerson. That really feels like what it was happening.
Yeah.
Total conjecture.
But yeah, so these are like, so to close out this piece, these are, you know, it looks like Rex Tillerson is going to, you know, is going to be confirmed. Yes, the United States government will get a bunch of money from Volkswagen and pay perhaps now from Fiat Chrysler for ignoring our emissions. But that doesn't take the emissions back out of the sky, right? There's no like that. And like that, I think that's the final piece of this, is that there's a level of just sort of like, well, what are we supposed to do then? You know, like, we can't take this $4 billion, and there's no way this $4 billion that VW is going to spend is going to be spent on, you know, sucking carbon out of the atmosphere. That's not what's going to be happening here. And so I think we'll continue with a little more depressing news as we move on to the second half. But I'll tease that we do have some, at least, like, some solutions maybe at some point coming up.
Yeah, actually, well, yeah, one of our regular writers, not a listener, but somebody who's been writing me a lot, requested that, you know, we try and insert a little bit more action items when possible, or we do a segment on action items. So this is an easy one today, because the interview we're doing at the end is this is something you can do.
Yes.
You have an actionable thing, even if it's just for your own sense of like feeling sane. We will have an actionable item for you on today's show.
Yeah,
possibly the first time ever. No,
yeah.
That's not true.
So I'm going to end with the last three tweets from Eric in just because I think it sort of sums up this bit of pretty well, which is that climate despair on its own isn't bad. You know, it's a sign you care. It's just hard to function when you feel the weight of the world crashing down. The more I talk about my despair, the more I realize other people feel the same thing. And that makes me hopeful, because we're more powerful than we think. I don't have an answer from where to go from here. That's why I'm in counseling. But part of the answer is don't be afraid to talk. And luckily, you know, we have no problem talking.
Nope. Frequently asked to stop talking. We have a guest tech this week. It's going to be Steven. Steven, would you be so kind as to just at least let the listeners know what our music break is going to be?
All right. Today we're going to be enjoying Ghosting by Vancouver, BC band Mother Mother, as chosen by CIUT's newest tech, Kai.
We are back. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. If you're listening live, Yes. If you're not listening live, you could be listening on one of our replay stations, which is one of our very appreciated community radio partners all the way across the country, now internationally as well. You could also be listening to this in an electronic form, which could be coming to you via Rabble. Perhaps you're catching this on the National Observer, or maybe you're listening to Green Majority's own podcast. If you are, you'll have a bonus show to look forward to. And I think just with keeping with last week's tradition of our special surprise guests getting to pick what we talk about, I have a prepared topic, but Sabina just surprised us. So I'm gonna give that to Sabina. Sabina will decide what our bonus show topic will be this week.
But if you are listening to us live, then we get to break news to you.
Number two.
For the second time ever.
Do it, Sabina.
At least in the last 3.5 years of my – it's both times has been good news, which I think is fun. The first time it was when during our show, again, it's very hard to have news drop between 11 and 12 on a Friday. Like, there's a many other hours that anything could happen, so it's rare we get to break news. But last time it was Keystone, when Keystone XL got stopped, or now probably paused, sorry. But this news is that the Line 9 water protectors who shut down Line 9earlier last year, had their charges dropped. They were today, so that's exciting. We should take that as a win. After I spent the last 20 minutes being depressed, that's an awesome news. They were facing 25 years, something like that, because it was claimed that they were endangering lives by shutting this thing down. So it's good to see that not only is that, you know, it's one thing to sort of, you know, to not have to go through legal stuff anymore, but I think 25 years is really quite the, you know, that's a heavy toll to put on someone.
It's no joke.
It's no joke, obviously. So it's unbelievably good news that the charges were dropped. So one piece of good news in the show. But please, you're leading the session.
Let's not take too much time from the bad news stuff.
All right, sorry. Let's go back to bad news.
We have to keep our priorities in line. I just wanted to sort of mention here on an offhand because I don't. I think really what we want to do if we're going to talk about this in any length would be to get an interview and whatnot. So I'm gonna talk about it, mention it just very quickly because I don't think I can do a good job if I dedicate more time to it. We will simply come back to it if we can. But I wanted to mention that there has been a lot of talk about the Ontario Power Generation, I think that's what it stands for, OPG, and where to put nuclear waste, because many people probably know, here in Ontario we generate a lot of power from nuclear energy, much to the chagrin of some of our occasional contributors. But the ongoing issue here is, where do we put this stuff? And a lot of the plans don't really have a good idea for that. Shockingly, I mean, many people who haven't looked at this be like, oh, come on, it can't really be that bad. They have to have had some idea. Well, not really. A lot of the time, the waste was sort of put in we'll deal with this later. We're going to dig a pit somewhere and then we'll come back to it when we have a better idea. And they really haven't come up with one. So currently, the thing I just want to announce today is that they're now looking to put a nearly 700-meter-deep limestone host rock about 1.2 kilometers from Lake Huron, which happens to be the drinking water for several million people, to bury a whole bunch of nuclear waste, which I believe, if I remember, only lasts like 10 or 15 years. Oh, wait. 10 or 15 lifetimes it will be there. So this is – I mean – as I said, I'm not an expert in this, and nuclear energy is not my expertise, other than the fact that I'm pretty sure that nuclear waste is bad for drinking water. But it just sort of like to keep an eye, because like one of the criticisms that is sort of said is that, well, you know, really the problem is that you don't understand how really the experts have checked, and this is, this is all fine. But as we keep coming back to with there's the issue with the drinking water for First Nations and pretending that there wasn't poisoning, and I'm blanking on the
Grassy Narrows,
thank you very much, for going on for 30 years before finally they're like, look, we can prove it. Here it is. You have to do something. A lot of the time it really is that bad. There really is nobody, sort of there. And when nobody is looking, people make easy decisions that are generally negative, but the negatives won't come up immediately, or they're pretty sure nobody will notice. And this isn't a matter of politicians being evil. This is a matter of You know, in some cases, I might say some of them are, but certainly it's not a like, oh, politicians are the worst. It's that there's a lot of really serious problems that we need to be dealing with. Climate change is the newest one, but this has been going back for quite some time. Nuclear waste is an ongoing issue that will maintain an ongoing issue, even if we shut down every plant tomorrow because of all the waste that's been generated. And it just – it speaks to me to a much larger need to have a much more holistic sense of how science interplays with policy, because the running theme on these – and we can easily, I don't even have to go there explicitly, you can use your imagination, draw some parallels to climate change, which is don't worry, this is really good for us in the short term and someone will figure it out later, doesn't ever happen. And we need to stop letting governments and companies use that argument that this will be – don't worry, we'll solve this problem later is not an acceptable answer. And I think that with the understanding that I have of this issue, that's about all I can say about it for now. But I will post the article. You can read more up on that as well. And also we have an occasional guest whose name I'm also blanking on, but the Ontario Canadian Association for Nuclear Responsibility, CANAR, has been the guest on the show. We've interviewed him in video format as well to learn more about that topic. There are probably a good number of people listening to this right now that are pulling their hair out because they're much more better informed than I am. I do apologize to them, but for now we'll have to leave it there. What I did want to spend a few more minutes on before we got to the interview was something that is at face value, not very substantive. It was the fact, other than the fact that it got a surprising amount of media attention, in fact, international media attention, and that was Jane Fonda coming out and basically saying that she was very disappointed with Trudeau and was very distressed about some of the climate change policy, very distressed about pipelines. It was not surprising to me. Stars, Hollywood stars, are frequently sided with environmentalists. Many stars that I like very much have done that. Film directors, a lot of big names. But of course, we've talked about on this show before, Stefan, that just because somebody famous says something doesn't mean they're right, and it doesn't mean that you should change your opinion. You certainly, under no circumstances, should ever change your opinion because of who said something. So what's the point? Now, the reason we're talking about this, A, was because I was surprised how insanely sensitive the government has been about – maybe they're all really big Jane Fonda fans and they were just really like personally hurt by this. I don't know. But I didn't really think it's a big story. Like when I saw it, it was like, yeah, whatever. Like yeah, so did a bunch of other stars.
And it's been happening consistently for the last 10, 15 years.
It's been happening consistently. But Premier Rachel Notley took this quite personally, it seems. There was quite a backlash. She's given a number of comments. Apparently, Jane Fonda was invited to meet with the government so that they could explain to her why she's so badly misinformed and why Trudeau is really the best and how pipelines are really the best. And there's two things I wanted to say about that. One is that, yeah, who cares what Jane Fonda says? the point is, it was in her own words, they asked her, in fact, very pointedly, so I'm now quoting from the last two sentences of the CBC article. After the panel discussion, several reporters asked Fonda why Albertans should listen to a celebrity outsider. She said, quote, when you're famous, you can help by amplifying voices that people that can't necessarily get the press. So she was basically saying you shouldn't. Yeah. I'm just here so that you covered this. Ha ha.
Well, that's what I find so funny about this is that this is the press attacking Jane Fonda for being there when they're only there because she is there. Like she's like in their existence to ask her the question, well, why should we listen to you? Her like she is proving the entire purpose of her being at this event. Like it's not like this is getting international attention. This is there's no way this panel gets anything close to this attention except for this one thing. And I love the idea of the press coming in and being like, well, why should we listen to you? And the answer is quite simply, that's not the point. The point is you just sat through an entire panel you never would have heard about only to ask me why anyone should listen to me. Well, that's the only reason you're here.
Exactly. And in this article, there's nearly four sentences of quotes from Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation Chief Alan Adam, who's blaming high cancer rates in his community on oil sands development. Four four quotes, nearly four full sentences that I guarantee you would never have made it into print without her. So,
and that's not a good thing. It proves the point that the media should be. If the media was covering this effectively, then you wouldn't need Jane Fonda.
Exactly.
If everyone knew the name of this person who was on the panel instead of Jane Fonda, then maybe they should go to a Jane Fonda screening so people go watch Jane Fonda's movies. That's not how we live.
So, the other really quick point, because there's one more thing I want to mention before we lead into our interview. So, just the last thing I want to say about that, unless anyone else has any pressing comments, was that the line here, and you can read it for yourself, and there was also an announcement that the Clark government greenlit Kinder Morgan, so they, you know, somebody contacted us, a listener contacted us to say, when we were saying, oh, here they go on Kinder Morgan, saying, hey, relax, you know, it's Clark's decision, and you'll wait and see. Now, I don't mean this in any sort of an I told you so situation. I wished I was wrong. Mm. And I'm not right because I knew better or because I'm smarter or anything like that. It's because my cynicism proved correct. It was pure cynicism. And it turned out that my cynicism was justified, not because I, you know, had better information or was making a better analysis in any way. So I'm sorry to have been right, but it did go ahead. And really, at the end of the day, like, what's going on here is that the government, and if you read the Clark article or if you read the conversation regarding the Jane Fonda conversation, is that if you listen to Notley and Trudeau and all the climate ministers, everybody talk about, you know, this is their line, and they're repeating it all very often. It's very politically, you know, this is how you operate, like, create political messaging. So they do know how to do it when it serves their purposes. Despite my other criticisms about other ways that they might be able to use that strategy to convince Canadians of, you know, the truth. But anyway, is this idea that Canadians know that environment and economy can go hand in hand. And I agree, it can. But what happened was that the Liberal government won a giant landslide, largely influenced by the fact that everybody agreed that Harper had to go. At the last minute, everyone seemed to agree that the best way to make sure that we didn't screw it up and that we definitely got rid of him was to vote for Trudeau. Then the Trudeau government comes in and says a bunch of nice things about climate change and develops a extremely weak, nice sounding, because it includes a lot of buzzwords that are good and a bunch of stuff that is legitimately good.
Yes.
Mixed in mandate that also includes committing to tripling the output of the carbon emissions from the oil sands and saying that this does not conflict with dealing with climate change because we're going to spend a tiny percent of, and we're not going to be specific about how much money on creating adaptation. But here's the problem, is that they go out and say Canadians understand this, and what they're saying is we have a mandate for this plan, but they developed the plan after they were elected, and the reason they were elected was to get rid of Harper. And so I'm concerned, A, because I'm wondering if they're actually deluded into thinking that their opinion is actually supported by most Canadians, and it's undeniably supported by some Canadians, but I'm really concerned that they're really, really overconfident of how many Canadians support their particular point of view. Because I think there's a bunch of people that agree with them not taking a firmer stance on climate change because they don't believe it exists. And then they're counting on a bunch of people who did vote for them but now hate them because they can see through their extremely inconsistent, is about the fairest I can put it, climate change policy. And I'm really concerned that we're, you know, looking at a repeat of a revolt. And they just assume that, and basically the other parties get the message that, hey, climate change is a loser. I guess he got Dion'd after all. Mm. And let's stop talking about climate change, when the thing is, no, it's just that the majority of the people who actually care about climate change could tell that this was a nonsense plan that didn't make any sense and that it's window dressing.
I think the mandate that he has is pretty similar to his actual vote share. You know, I think about 30% of Canadians honestly, you know, do believe that you can combine, that you can have that, you know, price on carbon, that's good, you know, other stuff that's also good. And again, I will go back in saying that what Trudeau is doing is excellent policy for the early 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
There, you know, to trade, I under, like, as politics go, to trade out oil, what he's given to the energy industry for a national price on carbon is a very reasonable way of going about this politically. If this was 20 years ago,
obviously we should have voted in Harper sooner so that he could have been universally rejected sooner so that Trudeau could have done this in 1995.
Well, I also think, yeah, at least also knows how long it takes to get people to understand the nature of these sort of things. But I think, you know, I do think that he has about probably 30% of the vote or of the people agreeing with him on that front. But I think what's interesting is that he's taking that 30% and understanding it's the same as his actual, as his, you know, not to go back to voting reform, but like if, you know, in a first past the post system, he's taking his first past the post mandate, which is 50-60, you know, up close to 60% of the seats, as the real mandate that he's received, despite the fact that he's really looking at 35-36% of the actual vote. And I think that's the, you know, I think to some extent that's where you land on whether or not he's really making this his case.
And I think the important difference here is that of those people that agree with him, it's not that you know, this is political difference. It's that they hear him talk about the investments that are going to be made and hear him talk about carbon plan and say, good, therefore, you know, ipso facto, climate change is dealt with. And anyone else who disagrees with this is just being irrational, just has an irrational hatred of pipelines and doesn't understand reality. When the reality is that a lot of this is smoke and mirrors. The goals that the targets that they've set for themselves and the commitments that they've made do not line up to their current policies. And those of us who are crying out of that aren't just simply like no pipelines under anything. Like, no, the math just doesn't work. Like those two things don't connect when you actually try and line them up. And there's a whole bunch of people that just don't have time to look into that and are just assuming because he sounds so friendly and reasonable, which was exactly Jane Fonda's point, which was stop being lured by, you know, slick talking pretty boys, is that when you actually look behind the mask, when you actually look into the details, none of this stuff actually makes sense. It is a plan. It is a plan that is going to be better than not having it, unquestionably. Does it meet the required targets? The answer is no. So let's leave it there for now. Sorry, we'll come back, Sabina. I want to get one more quick thing, and we only have a minute before the interview, which is just to mention very quickly, because this plays into our next interview as well. We'll post the article for you to read. I'll just overview it very quickly, which was that the Department of Energy in the United States is bracing for Trump's anti-science agenda, announcing an internal scientific integrity policy, which essentially codifies that Energy Department scientists are able to express their opinions. Energy Department scientists must get the opportunity to review department statements about their own work. And Energy Department officials should not and will not ask scientists to tailor their work to particular conclusions. Additionally, scientists will be allowed to speak to the media under any circumstances as long as it is being made clear that they do not represent their government or their office when doing so. This sounds really familiar. Preemptive strike. Will this last under Trump? Hard to say. Will this make it harder for him? And yes, I think it will, because it will at least make it much more public if he tries to essentially attack this internal policy rather than there not being a policy and him just sort of like putting pressure on people. I think it all this does is it doesn't actually protect anybody. What it does is that if they are attacked, it will make the fight very public because it's now conflicting with an official internal policy. And it will at least get some press, which could be enough to back them off. How much? Who can say? I don't think we can say yet. But we're going to ask our guest when we come back from the break about that and more, and about why he's been spending so much time on Breitbart, a terrifyingly racist, sexist, and a whole bunch of other bad words website.
Yeah,
I don't even want to call it a news site.
A
news site is less accurate. We're going to be talking to Nathan Glenn Phillips when we come back, professor, Boston University, Department of Earth and Environmental Science, I believe, from Boston. But before we do that, we have another music break. Stephen, please let us know what we're going to listen to.
All right, we'll be listening to a little more Mother Mother, this time a tune that I first heard back in Sudbury, Ontario, called Dirty Town.
We are back. You're listening to the final section now of the Green Majority Radio show. Possibly you're listening on the podcast as well. If so, we have more content coming out for you. But if not, this is it. So get in your last bit of enjoyment. We're going to go now to our interview, which is with Nathan Phillips, who's a professor of earth and environmental science at Boston University, which sounds very much in line with the show, other than the fact that we're going to be talking to him about Breitbart News. Are you there, Nathan?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking a little bit of time to talk to us today. We've been doing a little bit of conversation here and there about this ongoing concept of fake news. We had some other independent media organizations here in Canada join us recently to talk about sort of the marketplace idea of independent journalism, you know, anywhere from us to large organizations like, you know, some local independent news here like Rabble.ca or National Observer and stuff like that. But there is a dark side of it as well. And one of those people is Breitbart. And I think the reason why this is now an urgent issue was the founder of Breitbart News is now actually part of the American government, part of the official administration here. And that puts, I think, a particularly fine point on the danger. And you and a bunch of colleagues, I guess we can call them, known as the Sleeping Giants on Twitter, have found a way to at least in a little way fight back. And I would like to start by just allowing you to explain the story there. How did you get involved and what is it that's actually going on?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'd just like to say that I'm speaking today as an individual and not a representative of Boston University, because the problems that I have with Breitbart extend both from the racist, sexist types of things that they put on there to the science as well. So they're spreading hate and misinformation in a variety of dimensions. But getting to the reason how I got into this was I had heard news about Kellogg's, the cereal maker, and how they got out of Breitbart, and I saw that in the mainstream news, so I just wanted to check for myself who else is advertising on there. And to my surprise, I found that my graduate institution, Duke University, had the banner ad there, and that really made me feel like I needed to do something. So I tweeted at them, and fortunately they got off, but that's how I came across and found the Sleeping Giants Twitter account.
And so just to be clear for listeners who maybe haven't been a purchaser of ads before, we've done it very quickly. We did a test here. So I've been through that process. I know what that is a little bit like. But just for the listeners, I mean, this wasn't a case of the university going and looking up Breitbart and saying, can we please give you some money to advertise on your site? How does this actually work?
Correct. These are called retargeting ads, and most of the companies don't even know that they're being advertised on Breitbart. So basically, your internet cache follows you around, and that's how the ads were showing up. Interestingly, when I pointed this out to Duke as well as other institutions and organizations, one of the first responses was, that's not really us, that's you. But over time, we've seen that response is no longer good enough, because there's awareness that's built now where companies are starting to realize that they have responsibility to think about where they advertise and socially responsible advertising.
I think that's a really interesting angle to it too, because there's one thing which would just be, you know, the university or somebody else or Kellogg's, as you said, you know, going to Breitbart and saying we want to advertise on your site. That would be super easy. I think it is importantly different though, although I'm not sure how much as it changes it, as you just pointed out, that it's, well, I mean, the ads are almost like only part of the site to the end user. It's a combination of a bunch of different content that just simply gets presented on one page. And so I think there is an argument for the companies to say that, you know, plausible deniability, or say, well, this, you know, it's not, what do we have to do with it? So I'm sort of surprised actually to find out that this has been to some degree effective. Can you talk a little bit more about the effectiveness aside from simply getting the university itself to stop advertising?
Yeah, so I think a couple of things there. I don't want to disparage or blame any companies for having advertising on there without knowing it, because most of them don't know it. But once they're informed, they have an easy route to make a change if they want to, and they can make a decision at that point. I think that's an important point to make. The idea that on the internet, social media and these kinds of things are just platforms and just neutral, I think is becoming a harder thing to justify in general. So I think that it has been effective. I looked at the Sleeping Giant Twitter account, and there are over 600 companies and organizations and universities have blocked Breitbart from their ads now.
So I think, Nathan, that there's two really big issues here that I'm very curious to know what your thoughts are, because in this one case, I mean, Breitbart's easy, right? It's a cesspool of hate and fear and, having companies understand that, you know, is this really, like, really all you have to do? You don't have to make an argument. You just have to say, were you aware that your content was on this site? And most of them go, whoa. But I mean, when we're talking about sites other than Breitbart, I mean, I'm a little bit unsure how I feel about the idea of, you know, the companies having to, like, okay, well, who else do they know and where do they draw the line? Is it, you know, does it line up with their personal policies and how does that line up with their customers? It seems like, you know, Breitbart is a really easy answer. But if we start applying this in other areas, I feel like it could get messy very quickly. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I go back to a principle that is rock solid, and that's freedom of speech and freedom of choice. And you're not going to find a stronger proponent of that principle than me. So I think that can apply, that principle can apply to Breitbart, but it can apply to any website. And so Breitbart has the right to put hate speech there, and people have the right to align themselves with a headline that says birth control makes women unattractive and crazy. If they want to align themselves with that, they have the right to do that.
Well, and I want to point out that you didn't make that up. That's actually a quote.
Correct. And if you read the text, the actual story behind that headline, it's even worse. It's dripping with venom and misogyny. But there is the principle. They have the right to spout that. People have the right to align themselves with that. But I have the right to call them out, and no one's actually come back to me among the trolls or whoever saying I don't have the right to call them out. And companies have rights to make choices as well. So it's freedom of speech, it's freedom of choice across the board. And any website, I think that principle can apply to any website. We all have freedom.
So when we're talking about that, do you think this is something that that should be done on a wide scale? Like, are you advocating this type of action? Was this something that you think is limited? Should be and is currently limited to Breitbart? Is this something you sort of maybe are encouraging listeners to go out and do, or just making them aware that this is a possible tactic? A way to fight back? Would you actually advocate people going and doing this?
Well, this one is a focused campaign, and I really don't go out of my way looking for horrible websites. So I can't list a number of ones that are next on the list in my own head. I'm focused on this particular one, but the principle, you know, should apply. I think this is actually pushing socially responsible advertising and creating awareness that I do hope has more general benefits.
And so one of the other, I think, important things I wanted to talk to you about, of course, was the fact that this is incredibly off topic for you, obviously. Yeah. You know, when I was looking at your CV, when I was sent to me by our producer, the first thing that occurred to me was, you know, I was looking at just this wall of accreditations, and you've been the lead researcher on a number of very important science areas that have to do with the environment. This seemed like an incredible waste of your time. not in that it's not valuable, but it's like it really made me sad that someone with your qualifications needs to spend their time doing this.
There is a little nexus, though, because Breitbart has also, you know, contributed to climate misinformation as well. So there is a professional aspect to this. So, for example, one of the stories that they put out was claiming that last year was the coldest year on record, when in fact it was the warmest year on record. So from a professional point of view, and because some of my research is related to climate issues, I think that it's fair game from a professional point of view to point out the misinformation that they're contributing to.
And would you think that there's another are there other sites that you're particularly concerned about that that maybe could be looked at next, either by you personally or by the anonymous folks over at Sleeping Giants, or perhaps our listeners, if they're feeling like doing something productive today, if they're sort of depressed by the rest of the content we've talked about this week?
Well, the disinformation on this topic is widespread on a number of different platforms. But what really bothered me was that the House Science Committee was retweeting the misinformation that was put on Breitbart. So I think that we're in a time now, as you mentioned in your initial comments, in which this is melding right into our government and our political leaders. And so I'm looking at the pressure that we need to bring on our own leaders to stand up for science and stand with scientists rather than the misinformation that's being spread.
And so the last thing I think I'd like to talk to you about is the idea of there's sort of two micro things, but it has to do with again with the implications of this, because my first reaction to hearing that this was like, yes, something, you know, we can tell people to do and this is great, but I had sort of two more questions, which was, I mean, like, legitimately, regardless, I mean, we're not going to get anywhere near the electoral college stuff or any of that stuff or popular vote and whatever. The end of the day, however he won and however people feel about it, Trump won, and enough people voted for him to win. So my concern on the other end was it, do you have any concern at all about this perhaps working the other way around, and Trump folks seeing this as an opportunity to try and create a lot of intimidation around maybe people such as yourself or people such as ourselves, you know, smaller independent folks who are maybe, I mean, we don't advertise on our website, but is there a concern that this might actually cut both ways, or do you feel that most of the big companies that have a lot of sway are probably largely on the right side of these issues, and regardless of how many emails they get, aren't going to take ads off, you know, EcoWatch or something like that?
Yeah, a couple thoughts on that. One is that Trump is going into his presidency with record low approval ratings from the population at large. So the idea that he's going in with a mandate is not correct. A small majority, relatively small group are approving of where he's at now. And his picks have been horrible for his cabinet. So the idea that there can be a reset, that's not being pointed out as well. I believe that silence is complicity, silence is acquiescence, and it's for the people who have the ability to speak out, like myself, I feel like it's important to do so. I understand that other people in other jobs or positions may not have the freedom to speak out and be vocal in the way that I have, and I respect that as well. So we all try to improve the world as we see fit, and, you know, when it comes down to science and what we understand about science and our world and climate change, I'm not going to be quiet about it. So the other thing that I would just add is that there's one thing that we all agree on, including 75% of Trump supporters and voters, is the transition that we need to make to clean energy. And so I always want to tie the message about the problems that we have with our climate to the solutions, and that's something we can all get behind.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the, I've been, like many other folks, have been glued to my screen for sort of 2 months now. And one of the things, I've been watching a lot of the clips with Bernie Sanders town halls since the election, and a lot of people going out and actually talking to these Trump voters, you know, who are, you know, and so, you know, the normal dismissal or the common dismissal was, you know, a bunch of racist white men. But then when they'd see, you know, perhaps a black woman who is wearing a Trump shirt or something like that, journalists started being like, well, this doesn't fit the profile that we had. And they were going and talking to them. And one of the interesting things that I think has happened since the election has been an unprecedented amount of commingling of, like, actual people from these two extreme points of view are beginning to actually have conversations. And one of the things, I mean, aside from that just being good to do anyway, is that we've noticed is that a lot of those folks who voted for Trump, or maybe they didn't, but or would consider themselves, you know, part of the right and maybe are a little bit skeptical about climate change, you know, whether or not, you know, that's a valid point of view to have, that's their point of view, is that a lot of them, you know, really agree. We agree on a lot more than I think we think we do. And I think that, you know, regardless of all of that, that actually getting out and having these conversations and not just, I mean, I don't think my show would convince any Trump voters because I don't think they would listen through it, but actually going out and having a person-to-person conversation with them, as opposed to here's a bunch of information I want you to accept because I said so, may be ultimately the only way forward. I'll give you the last word on that, Nathan.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. The poster person on that thing for me is Debbie Dooley, who started the Atlanta Tea Party and is one of the strongest proponents of the transition to clean energy. So we do need to make those connections. It's the one thing I think we can all get together behind, is the clean energy transition.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And Nathan, it would be our pleasure to have you back sometime to actually talk about Earth and Environment Science.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for your time again. That was Nathan Phillips, a professor for the Earth and Environmental Science at Boston University, who made it clear, and I will remake clear, was not making comments on behalf in any way of the university. It was simply an interesting connection that he, of course, found his school's ads on Breitbart. And we've got about only about 1 minute left here. Sabina, I could easily fill that minute, but you had your hand up earlier. Do you want to sneak your quick comment in here, or do you want to save it for the bonus show?
I think I'll save it for the bonus.
Okay. So we'll recap a little bit this week's news as well, a fun story around Jane Fonda. I think the funnest part about it was how widely ranged that got. So you'll find links to that as well on the show. I also wish that I'd had more time to talk about a little bit about the Kinder Morgan issue. And of course, I wish I was better informed to be talking about the nuclear waste issue as well. So if you're interested in those topics and were not satisfied with my coverage, please do check out the show post, which is at greenmajority.ca. You'll find links to all those stories and more. You can also do what a lot of people have been doing recently. Stefan, we've got a big uptick in listener email.
Which is always fun.
Use the contact us, including we just had a former official negotiator for one of the COP, I won't say who or from where yet until it's absolutely confirmed, but an official COP negotiator from a non-North American, representing a non-North American country. Contact us asking to be on the program. That will probably be coming up soon, which is awesome. I'm pumped. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back in a minute with a bonus show if you're listening to the podcast. If not, take care. Have a good green week, folks, and we'll see you all real soon.